friction, if any, because another feature of Jerusalem's landscape is overlapping and intertwining grids that are designed never to intersect. So you can live in the liberal, secular, Jewish part of the city and never have to set foot in the Haredi sectors, the Palestinian neighborhoods, or any of the settlement neighborhoods. The same is true to varying degrees for residents of these different zones as they go about their daily lives. The three major sectors even used to conduct their affairs in three different languages, Hebrew, Arabic, and Yiddish, although Yiddish is now mostly conceded ground to Hebrew. Certainly everyone in the city has made a clear choice with regard to that most critical of decisions, which has the most far-reaching influence in determining where their communities will develop a sense of belonging to. It's a decision that carries so much potential risk that in many countries the government makes it for its citizens, or at least mandates close supervision and regulation. That potentially dangerous and subversive decision, of course, is where one sends her children to school. And in Jerusalem, there are at least five confessional enclaves, complete with their own independent educational ecosystems. I have a little graph that shows. So there's the Haredi school system, the secular Jewish public schools, national religious Jewish public schools, the public Arabic schools, and lastly the private, mostly Christian-run Arabic schools. And that barely shows anything. But maybe you can see the pie, and you can kind of see the proportions. The biggest block is Haredi at about 38%. The next biggest block is the public Arabic schools. Those are that's at 31%, and secular Jewish schools in Jerusalem, those are only 12%. And then the national religious schools, those are 11%. They're fast rising. That'll probably in the next couple of years take over from secular schools. And then there's the private Arabic schools are at 8%. So one of the interesting points about this chart is that whenever I've asked anyone from any one of the above communities what they would guess is the approximate size of each, they're almost always way, way off. Everyone's estimation of each of the constituent parts is almost always wildly disproportionate, like a Picasso painting. It's a bit like trying to draw a map of Jerusalem, if you've ever tried. The roads quite never meet up where they're supposed to because you've drawn some longer and others shorter than they are in reality. Or have you ever taken a certain route that you've believed to be the fastest only to find out later after seeing on Google Maps that a different route was shorter? You have to completely reconfigure in your mind how you relate to that physical space, and it can be disorienting, even a little embarrassing at first, to think that you were so fixated on a misconception. This city, and it's both a microcosm and a harbinger for the rest of the country, thrives on fears, lies, antagonisms, and misconceptions of one community for another, like algae grows on a leaky sewage pipe. For example, we recently witnessed a massive protest against military conscription of Haredim, who believe the secular government is conspiring to destroy their world of Torah study. Secular national religious Jews, on the other hand, accuse them of living parasitically off subsidies while refusing to serve the state. Meanwhile, Palestinians raise the alarm about government efforts to Judaize eastern parts of the city through building schemes, while the government will point to incitement to violence in the Palestinian media and mosques. Muslim, Jewish, and Christian clerics, priests, pastors, and rabbis will all unite in unprecedented accord against the annual pro-gay march. But then, even most secular Jews will join that crowd that was just united against them to protest Christian missionaries who are hated unanimously by all. Now, these are extremely stereotypical characterizations, and they don't even begin to represent the vast nuanced spectrum of positions that exist within every community. One can find a wealth of generous tolerance at times within every community. But in general, my impression is that the prejudices predominate. Prejudices, like all prejudices, that are based partly on fact and partly on fiction. So this week I attended a conference held by the Bethlehem Bible College called Christ at the Checkpoint. As you might infer from the name, the conference sought to address how Christians, Palestinian Christians, should respond to Israeli military control or to Zionism more generally. Now from here, there is a lot I could say about the conference and so easily descend into the abyss that is the contentious debate between Zionism and Palestinian nationalism and where the Bible fits into that debate. But don't worry, I'm not about to infuriate half of you or most of you. But that's just the point. Amazingly, we've somehow managed to maintain a fairly mixed attendance here at Narkis, with congregants falling on various sides on this issue. And that's not to be taken for granted. Most of the congregations in this land are not this way. They are clearly on one side or the other. I imagine most of you are still here only because, in addition to the worship, spiritual nourishment, and fellowship you expect from a congregation, you have developed the fortitude to stomach the occasionally disagreeable, off-putting, even heretical message. But is this the price we have to pay to suffer fools because there's nowhere better to go? Or is there a greater principle we can adopt? There was an astonishing amount of acrimony among Christians on all sides of the debate as they discussed this very controversial conference, this Christ at the Checkpoint. Much of it, no doubt, stemming from a place of fear that their position was being marginalized, their security compromised on both sides. And the most natural reaction is to disassociate from, or better, attempt to discredit a potentially harmful idea. So there were all kinds of calls to boycott or condemn the Bethlehem Conference, which frankly reminded me of the mirror opposite masses who proclaimed that they wouldn't be caught dead at a Christian pro-Israel conference. We Christians are kings of schism. There are so few of us in this land, and yet divided into so many denominations, sects, and political ideologies, that we're not a witness, we're a joke first. Our lives may be a witness, God may be working in us and through us, but first people have to get past this sad, pathetic display of incoherence, and then, despite this horrifying mess, someone might be impressed by something real. But there's hope. My impression is that Jesus operated within a similar sort of political and religious communal environment. And being a political junkie, I love how often Jesus makes specific reference to these contentious issues sometimes, even accentuates them rather than ignore them. And that's what he does with the Syrophoenician woman in Mark 7, 25 through 30. For a woman whose young daughter had an unclean spirit heard about him, and she came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she kept asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. But Jesus said to her, "Let the children be filled first. It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." And she answered, and she said to him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this saying, go your way. The demon has gone out of your daughter." And when she had come to her house, she found the demon gone out and her daughter lying on the bed. This, of course, is an odd little story. This doesn't sound like Jesus here. But I agree with the view that Jesus' comments about throwing food to the dogs are said tongue-in-cheek. In fact, he makes the provocative comment precisely because he expects the witty banter. Essentially, he's saying, you, a Phoenician, are asking me if I'll pray for you. You do understand that I live within a certain political religious climate among a people, some of whom believe your people are no better than dogs, don't you? And her response is so brilliant because she gets that this is a game of wit, that the jab isn't meant for her. She could have returned fire for fire and said something like, that's a very chauvinist and ethnocentric worldview for you to refer to me as a woman and as a Phoenician as a dog. You should recognize that we are all equal. Instead, she plays along and plays on the sympathies of even someone who could think so coarsely. Yet even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs. There may have been good reasons not to associate with Syrophoenicians. Good reasons can always be found. Like the sinful woman who washed Jesus' feet with her hair. The Bible doesn't say what she did, but I think it might be safe to guess it wasn't bank robbery or white-collar crime that earned her her reputation. Here's Luke 7:36 through 39. Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus was at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil, stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. Isn't there a verse that says, avoid the appearance of evil? He could have at least done that. Let's recreate the scene here. Jesus, who was about 30 years old, not 60, i.e. not my dad, but closer to Keith, is reclining at the table with some new Pharisee friends. A woman of ill repute has awkwardly sat down close to him in the middle of their dinner, and she's crying, and she's rubbing his feet with oil and her hair. And apparently this goes on for at least a little while, because when Jesus is explaining his parable afterwards, he says, this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since I came in. Obviously nothing improper has happened. There's no accusation of impropriety. Probably everything that transpired would have been acceptable if it weren't for her reputation. But Jesus isn't quick to clear that misunderstanding up. Don't worry, everybody, she gets saved at the end of this. We know the parable he tells after. There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. He owned 500 denarii, and one owned 500 denarii, the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more? Simon answered and said, I suppose the one he forgave more. And he said to him, You have rightly judged. Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. Jesus is essentially saying to the Pharisees, if we're preaching forgiveness and salvation and all that, then everyone gets a place at the table right now. We don't force certain people through the back door, and we don't worry about what the association does to our reputation. And by the way, Jesus and the Pharisees were usually in agreement on most theological points. But if they weren't, like when they question how it was that he could forgive her sins, He wasn't afraid of remaining associated with them either. That he remained in communion with Judas despite foreknowledge of his plans should be evidence enough of that fact. There are loads of examples of Jesus purposely drawing attention not just to his message, but to his associations with not just unseemly sinners. When we say Jesus and sinner in the same sentence, it loses all its potency. Zacchaeus was a hardened criminal. It takes a real heart of stone to look people in the eye and steal their money. He had stolen, usurped, and siphoned money off into his coffers, corrupting the system with impunity. This is not a cutesy story before his transformation. When Jesus yells across the crowd so that everyone can hear, "Zacchaeus, I must stay in your house today," nobody's impressed. There isn't an eruption of applause. No one is hopeful. No one knows the sycamore song yet. In fact, imagine a Christian leader that you hitherto had respect for cozying up to some corrupt official. The only way you could excuse him or her is if they demonstrably were critical of that said official. But that isn't how Jesus does it. He advertises loudly that he's about to go hang out with the mafia. The last example I sometimes wonder about is the Roman centurion who believes that Jesus doesn't have to physically come to his house, but just say the word and his servant will be healed. I wonder what people must have thought when Jesus said, "I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." I know that this was a Roman centurion who was sympathetic to the Jews, but still, he was a part of the imperial occupying power that at times wielded that authority brutally. Not a single person in Israel had faith that could compare to this pagan infidel, however nice he was. Again, take your worst nightmare, a villain of a political or military figure, make a believer out of him, and be scandalized by Jesus saying, "I have not found such great faith, not even among Christians." Clearly, Jerusalem is divided religiously, politically, and communally. In Jesus' time, it's as divided religiously, politically, and communally in Jesus' time as it is today. And while Jesus seemed willing to cross any ideologically or socially constructed boundary to communicate his message, we have built a labyrinth of good excuses about why we should isolate and insulate ourselves from most others. Jesus would visit Pharisees who liked him or despised him in public or in secret. He socialized with people from every socioeconomic background. He was friendly with non-Jews, Samaritans, Phoenicians, and Greeks. He was willing to accommodate officialdom all the way to the cross. One of the things that the Syrophoenician woman, the Roman centurion, and Zacchaeus had in common was an unmistakable humility. And I admit humility is something I severely lack towards people I disagree with theologically or ideologically. My stomach literally aches with intolerance toward certain people. But as Christians, how can we be so small numerically, claim to have the truth, and yet have even more divisions than the rest of the country combined? In fact, in this city, I am less likely to be bothered by tax collectors, prostitutes, or Samaritans than I am by the guy two rows and five seats over, or certainly by the church three blocks away. That's pathetic. If we can't even overcome our own schisms, then we have nothing to say to the world, nothing hopeful, nothing credible. But if, on the other hand, all these boundaries are negotiable, then we definitely have something hopeful, even miraculous. If here at Narcisse we can have both old people and young people, charismatic and non-charismatic, people who take differing views on prophecy or inerrancy, or whether there should be a one or a two-state solution, then we may really be approaching the day when the wolf shall lay with the lamb. And I don't take that lightly, actually. At least, I'm trying not to. By this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another, the verse says. If Jesus went to the cross to reconcile us to him, I can at least go get a coffee with my adversary. Lord, give me strength.